So imagine discovering that everything you thought you knew about your own culture's history was actually just a long-standing popular mistake.
Oh, that would be completely world-shattering.
Right. Well, welcome to today's deep dive. We are looking at a really fascinating correspondence that was published on June 27, 2026.
Yeah, an article called "The Prevalence of Magic is Not Evidence of Its Truth."
Exactly. And it is this incredible back and forth between a rationalist teacher at a pre-military academy, a place called Hemdat in the Jordan Valley, and a scholar, Rabbi Adir Dakuch Halevi.
Through Chen Shalhoff, yeah. And they aren't just, squabbling over ancient dates. They are debating the very soul of ancient Judaism.
Basically, the big question is, was ancient Judaism always this purely rational, logical religion that just got corrupted by pagan magic later on? Or
Or was it always steeped in mysticism and demons right from the start?
exactly. And our mission today is to just explore this intellectual debate.
And we should probably add a quick disclaimer here.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Because this text touches on some very deep theological and historical arguments. So our goal today isn't to endorse one theological viewpoint for you or, take sides on whether magic is real.
Right, we're not ghost hunters here.
Exactly. We just want to unpack the fascinating arguments and the evidence presented in this specific text.
So let's get into it. The core conflict starts with this teacher's dilemma. He desperately wants to teach a rational version of Judaism.
Because he's teaching future leaders, so truth really matters to him.
Right. And he originally bought into this claim that the religion was, totally clean of mysticism until the Middle Ages, specifically until the appearance of what he calls the Book of Darkness.
Which is pretty much a thinly veiled reference to the Zohar, right?
Yeah, the foundational Kabbalah text. But the teacher confesses this really relatable fear. He says this rationalist view feels like a forced interpretation.
But he's just ignoring what the actual texts say.
Exactly. He feels like he's doing intellectual acrobatics. So he starts his argument with the Bible itself.
And he makes this really crucial distinction right out of the gate.
Yeah, between the massive national miracles and individual practical magic.
Right, like the splitting of the Red Sea. He points out that the Bible itself attributes that to a strong east wind blowing all night.
So there's almost a naturalistic framework there.
Right.
But then he brings up the prophet Elisha, and this is where it gets weird.
Elisha isn't splitting seas. He's doing things that look an awful lot like local sorcery.
Yeah. A heavy iron axe falls into the river, and Elisha makes it float by throwing a specific piece of wood into the water,
And later, he heals the poisoned water of Jericho by throwing salt into the spring.
which, okay, let's unpack this. It's like looking at the history of early medicine,
Yeah,
right?
that's a good way to look at it.
Because you can't just edit out the bloodletting and the leeches because it doesn't fit modern science. I mean,
Man.
they were in the official medical textbooks.
They absolutely were, and Elisha is using physical components like wood and salt to manipulate reality.
It looks exactly like spellcasting. But the teacher's next example is even darker. King Saul visiting the Witch of Endor.
Oh, this is a huge problem for the rationalist view.
Saul is desperate, so he asks this witch to raise the dead prophet Samuel. And the text points out that while necromancy is strictly outlawed,
The narrative treats it as completely real.
yes, it's not a scam. She actually summons Samuel, and Samuel is furious about being woken up.
Right, the fact that the Bible has to outlaw it and treats it as a functioning phenomenon suggests magic was just a regular part of the reality.
Doesn't the sheer volume of these stories kind of prove the teacher's point? Like, mysticism was foundational.
It's hard to argue against it. And the teacher doesn't stop at the Bible. He moves forward to the Talmud and even physical archaeology to prove that magic was just baked into everyday Jewish life.
And the Talmudic examples are just wild. I mean, we're not talking about subtle metaphors here.
No, not at all.
There's the story of Rava allegedly creating a literal man, a golem, using the Book of Creation, the Sefer Yetzirah.
And he sends this creature to Rabbi Zira.
Right. And Rabbi Zira tries to talk to it, realizes it's magical, and just casually commands it to return to your dust.
What's amazing about that story is there's no grand moral attached to it. It's just a raw demonstration of power.
Like it's a normal Tuesday for them. And they had all these protective spells against named demons, too, like Shabriri and Ketev Mary.
They even had everyday superstitions woven into their diets.
Oh, yeah, the cups of wine. The Talmud has bans on drinking an even number of cups.
Right, to avoid summoning demons.
Wait, really? Why does an even number summon a demon?
It's based on this concept of zugot, or pairs. The belief was that demons, especially one named Ashmedai, were drawn to dualities. So doing things in pairs left you spiritually vulnerable.
So they're literally changing their drinking habits to avoid demons. But it wasn't just folklore, right? It impacted actual religious law, the halakha.
This is a massive analytical point from the source text. The rabbis actually allowed people to carry what they called expert amulets on the Sabbath.
And carrying anything on the Sabbath is normally a huge violation.
Huge! But they made a legal loophole for amulets that were proven to heal people.
Meaning they tested them. If a man was possessed by a demon, didn't that affect his legal status too?
Yes. If a possessed man gave his wife a divorce document, the rabbis could legally invalidate it because his mental state was compromised by the demon.
A legally recognized demonic possession. Wow. And if that isn't enough, the teacher brings in the physical archaeology.
Hard evidence from the dirt itself.
Yeah, metal amulets invoking angel names found in places like Sapori and even in the Cairo Geniza.
The Geniza is crucial. That's where they stored sacred texts that couldn't be thrown away.
And they found magic amulets mixed right in with the sacred scrolls, so the people using them didn't see a contradiction at all.
And in Iraq, they found hundreds of these incantation bowls.
Oh, the upside-down bowls.
Yeah, buried under the floorboards of homes to physically trap demons, like Lilith.
Here's where it gets really interesting for me. If the ancient rabbis are literally changing Sabbath laws to accommodate magical amulets, and people are burying demon traps under their kitchens,
how can anyone claim this religion was originally clean of magic?
Exactly. So how does Rabbi Adir even begin to counter this? He's facing a mountain of evidence.
It's a fascinating pivot. Rabbi Adir relies on separating what the people actually did from what the religion actually teaches.
So he just admits the history is real.
Completely. He fully concedes that Jews practiced magic. In fact, he says these practitioners were often the overwhelming majority.
Okay, so then how does he defend the rationalist view?
His core thesis is the title of the article. The prevalence of magic is not evidence of its truth.
Oh, wow.
He argues that magic is the root of pagan idolatry. The original Torah was vehemently opposed to it. So the fact that Israelites practiced magic isn't proof that magic is authentically Jewish.
It's just proof that they were constantly sinning.
Exactly, adopting pagan nonsense from their neighbors.
So what does this all mean for the listener? The rabbi is basically saying, just because everyone is doing it doesn't mean it's the rule. It's like looking at highway traffic. If 90% of people are speeding, a historian might look at that and say, well, speeding is the culture of the highway.
But the police officer says, no, the speed limit is the rule. You're all just breaking it.
That is a perfect way to put it.
Yeah.
And the rabbi says this historical deviation had huge theological consequences.
Yeah, he argues this is exactly why the nation suffered terrible punishments and long exiles. Because they abandon reason for magic.
Okay, but what about the text itself? If the religion strictly rejects magic, how does Rabbi Adir account for the miracles, like Elisha floating the axe?
He redefines how miracles work. He says true prophets don't have innate supernatural magical powers.
They are wizards.
Right. Miracles are hyper-localized divine interventions. God grants them purely in response to a prophet's prayer in that specific moment.
So Elisha didn't do it. God did it for Elisha.
Exactly. Yeah. And the rabbi says anyone claiming independent magical powers is just a false prophet.
Interesting. But what about all the wild stories in the Talmud? The demons and the golems?
This is where he leans heavily on metaphor over literalism. He relies on Maimonides for this.
Ah, Maimonides, the ultimate rationalist.
Right. In his Guide for the Perplexed, Maimonides argues that while most of the Torah is literal history, things like prophecy, the creation, the chariot, those are metaphors.
So taking Talmudic legends literally is actually destructive.
According to the rabbi, yes. It's the destruction of the religion. Literalism leads to idolatry.
So how does he debunk the specific examples? Like, what about the evil eye? People were terrified of the evil eye.
He claims the evil eye is a realistic psychological phenomenon, not a magical one.
Wait, like a psychosomatic thing.
Exactly. If you know someone is looking at you with deep envy or hatred, the psychological stress of that can physically make you sick.
That is amazing intellectual gymnastics. He completely strips the supernatural out, but keeps the phenomenon real.
Yeah.
What about the Sefer Yetzirah, the spellbook Rava used to make the golem?
He dismisses it as a later forgery.
Just throws it out.
Pretty much. He says the Talmud actually referred to Hilshat Yetzirah, which means the laws of creation.
Meaning what, exactly?
Meaning they were just studying the natural laws of physics and biology, not reading a spell book.
Wow. He really aggressively filters everything through this lens of pure rationalism and natural law. But why does this debate matter today? We aren't burying incantation bowls anymore.
Well, we move from ancient history directly to our modern worldview here, and there's a surprising twist at the end of the source text.
Oh.
Rabbi Adir doesn't see modern science as the enemy of faith.
A lot of religious scholars do, though.
Right, but he views modern science and human intellect as the ultimate tools to finally purge these thousands of years of pagan, magical nonsense from Judaism.
So science is actually a spiritual tool for him.
Yes. His ultimate goal is that by embracing science and reason, the religion can finally return to its original rational roots.
And actually become the kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Which really makes you think about how we live today. I mean, how often do you let superstitions dictate your own behavior without even realizing it?
Knocking on wood, avoiding walking under ladders.
Checking your horoscope. This debate really highlights that the struggle between rational thought and comfortable superstition is just a timeless human condition.
It really is.
Well, to summarize this incredible deep dive, we've explored this massive tension. You have a teacher pointing at overwhelming historical and textual evidence of magic, the amulets, the spells, the legal loopholes.
And on the other side, a rabbi arguing that this evidence only proves a history of human failure and demanding a return to pure rationalism.
It's fascinating. And I think it leaves you with a really provocative question to ponder on your own.
Yeah, think about this. If a religion's followers practice a tradition one way for thousands of years and the texts reflect that lived reality, at what point does the popular deviation just become the actual tradition?
That is the million-dollar question.
Who ultimately gets to define a culture? The pure, original blueprint kept by scholars, or the messy reality of the people who actually lived it?
A perfect thought to end on. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the history behind your own everyday beliefs, and we'll catch you next time.